Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you downloaded us from. Thanks very much for downloading us. This is 1004B. The B's are always the guest segments. And we have two wonderful guests for you today. They come from the national, I'm not going to tell you where they come from quite yet. But they are wonderful, and it's a subject that we've covered a few times in different ways, but this is the first time in this way. As usual, our sponsor is Persona Nutrition. You can take the free online assessment at mypersona.com, mypersona.com, and find out from a nutritionist or dietitian what you're missing or not, and how to get it in your diet. Today we have two guests, a Dr. Powell and a Dr. White. Dr. Patricia Powell is the, and I should say Dr. Powell, please correct me, is the Deputy Director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And Dr. Aaron White is head interim director of the epidemiology branch, I believe, of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And they're going to talk to us about something I'm really very concerned about, which is that the deaths of despair have been increasing progressively. I call alcoholism and dying from alcohol usage a death of despair, and it has been increasing since around 2000, maybe before that, but in any case, it's also increased during this period. So I guess I'm going to first start with Dr. White and then Dr. Powell. So Dr. White, how did you get to the National Institute on Alcohol, if you will, the NIH version of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and what? Because you took a circuitous route.
I did. That is correct. Yeah, I've been studying alcohol and the brain and the rest of the body in one capacity or another for about 25 years since I started graduate school. And back then, when I first started, I was interested in alcohol and memory, particularly alcohol-induced blackouts. And I followed that as far as I wanted to follow it, and I branched out and started looking at other things, alcohol and adolescent brain development, and eventually found my way to this institute, which of course is the largest institute on the planet for studying and funding research on alcohol and public health, and I've been here for about 12 years.
And when they say you're head of the epidemiology branch, what does that mean? What is it that you study that's different from what other people may be studying, and what do you mean by biometry?
Good questions. So at our institute, we have four divisions. One of the divisions is epidemiology and prevention research. And within that division, we have a branch called the epidemiology and biometry branch, which is focused on collecting data from national surveys, analyzing data from secondary analyses from existing data sets, essentially trying to use population level data to track and monitor alcohol and public health.
And now, I assume there is something similar in England or in France or in Mexico and in Canada. Is there something similar? Do you compare data, or is the United States relatively unique in having this type of an institute?
Oh, no, there are other institutes, various types of institutes around the planet. The World Health Organization comes to mind. I mean, they do a lot of the stuff on a much grander scale than we try to do here with epidemiology. But it's basically just using all the data we can collect from people regarding their alcohol use, and comorbid conditions to try to keep track of where the trends are heading, what the important topics are to address. For instance, in a study that Dr. Powell and I did using death certificates to look at alcohol-related deaths in the U.S. to track whether, for instance, alcohol-related harm is increasing in a way that leads to more deaths related to alcohol. And so it's really using lots of data to sort of get our finger on the pulse of the impact of alcohol on public health.
And Dr. Powell, how did you get, you're in a esteemed position, I should say, to get to be a director or deputy director. I assume you guys are in Building 31, is that right? Or are you in, where are you at NIH, so to speak, or are you off campus?
We're actually not on the main NIH campus, which is in Bethesda, Maryland, but we're just a few miles down the road from there. So NIH is comprised of 27 institutes and centers. The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism is one of those 27, and so we're a little bit spread out.
How did you get to, so for our listeners who probably, many of whom probably understand this, but for those who don't, this is not a either a benign administrative or benign scientific position. That is, there's a lot of rigor in both. And so how did you get to where you are?
Well, my PhD and my early training was as a cellular and molecular biologist, so looking at the very fine-grained aspects of an organism. And I came to NIAAA through a science policy and technology fellowship through the American Association of the Advancement of Science. So taking a different view of things from the typical bench science, but looking from, you know, the policy perspective of how we make a difference in a lot of people's lives and how we fund research that can make a difference. So in my position as deputy director, I basically work in concert with our director to determine the research priorities of our institute. And for the grants to go out to the universities and research institutions across the country, and we support research to study all aspects of alcohol and health, from the basic brain kind of studies that Aaron White worked on in his early days, to research on the effects on other organisms, the liver, the heart, and others. Alcohol is an equal opportunity harmful agent. It affects almost every organ in the body, to epidemiological research, to research on diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of alcohol use disorders and the associated problems, be it liver disease and others, and then all the way to policy research. So we really span the gamut. We only focus on one agent, alcohol, but the research portfolio is very broad.
Now, I want to get to alcohol interactions as well as the data you've accumulated, but I heard Dr. White mention that one of the studies you used, and one that I'd love to delve into on the changes in, if you will, the death rates and deaths from alcohol, or what we call one of the major deaths of despair. What's happened since the 1960s, if you will, if you go back that long? And the reason I'm also want to find out one more thing is that when I was filling out death certificates as an intern and resident and then faculty member, the family would often come to me and say, don't put alcoholism, put, you know, liver failure, something like that, as the diagnostic criteria for when that person died. And so is that still happening? Is that social pressure on physicians to not put alcohol as a cause of death on the death certificates? And maybe the deaths are underestimated, meaning they're greater than they actually are reported. But first, what's happened since the 1960s overall?
Sure. So if we look at per capita consumption, the amount of alcohol that people drink in a given year per person in the country, per capita consumption actually climbed steeply beginning around 1960, went up about 50% between 1960 and 1985, where it peaked. Our highest point in per capita consumption in the United States over the last century actually happened in the mid-80s. And then it fell quite a bit from the mid-80s until around 2000, and it's been climbing since. So over the last 20 years, there has been about a 10% increase in per capita consumption. Might not sound like a lot, but it's a lot of extra alcohol. And with that increase in per capita consumption, we've been seeing an increase in alcohol-related emergency department visits, hospitalizations, and deaths. And one of the compelling trends is that these outcomes are climbing more steeply for women than for men. And for some age groups, we now see that women are actually drinking more than men and are more likely to tell us they get drunk. And so there's sort of two things that have been happening over the last 50 or 60 years, these changes in per capita consumption and also shifts in who's doing the drinking. So to answer the question about, you asked two questions. One was about per capita, the underreporting. Yeah, that is still an issue. We know, for instance, that if we look at all of the people that die in alcohol-related traffic crashes in which they have a blood alcohol level of 0.08 or higher, which is the legal limit for intoxication, only about one in five death certificates for those folks mention the involvement of alcohol. I'm not sure how much of that is pressure to leave it out, or how much of it is sort of lack of appreciation for the contribution of alcohol. And sometimes alcohol is hard to recognize the contribution of alcohol to a death. For instance, we've learned that one drink a day for women increases your risk of breast cancer by about 10%. But it would be difficult for somebody filling out that death certificate to have any insight into the possibility that alcohol contributed to that particular death.
Well, I think just to add to that, you know, for the acute causes, it may be more apparent and it may get left off for other reasons. And sometimes I think even when there's another drug on board, they may not test for alcohol. But I think the other issue is sometimes it's just more insidious. So if especially an elderly person falls, by the time they get to the emergency room and get seen and treated for that, the alcohol may be long out of their system, but the alcohol may be the precipitating factor for the fall. So I think, you know, in cases like that, it just may not be recognized.
Now, since the year 2000, which is some of the data you've recently accumulated, these deaths have gone up substantially. Is that correct, as I understand it?
That is correct. The rate of deaths climbed about 51% between 1999 and 2017, and the number essentially doubled. There were just about a million.
So we've doubled. And when you say, why did the rate only go up 51% if the absolute number doubled? Our population didn't increase that much, did it?
Yes, the population increased, and it increased. And so when you do all the math, it comes out that the rate increase is about 51%, but the actual number, the rate takes into consideration the age of people as well. And so it's not as clear cut as it appears at first glance, but once you take into consideration the changes in number of people in the various age groups that are dying, it turns out that the rate has gone up about 51%. But that adds up to about a million extra deaths, a million total deaths between 1999 and 2017 from alcohol-related causes. And that could be alcohol-related cirrhosis of the liver, overdoses involving alcohol and or other drugs. It could be from falls, as Dr. Powell said, car crashes. But nearly a million people died in that 18-year period from reasons associated with alcohol.
And it probably is underreported, as we've talked about.
We assume that it is. We assume that it is based on evidence, like I shared with you, that if we look at the number of car crash fatalities and we look at the number of those death certificates that mention alcohol, it's a small fraction that mention the alcohol. Yet we know that at 0.08, alcohol more than likely contributed to that crash.
Now, I want to get to two other points, and either of you can answer this. One is, have you been able to track, there has been a description in the literature and among physicians and widely popularized in the public press what is called a U-curve on all-cause mortality relating to small, meaning one drink a night for, one half to one drink a night for women, one to two for men, actually decreasing all-cause mortality. Can you trace how much that's contributed? And the second question I'd like to get to, and I can't believe how fast time flies, the second question I really want to get from Dr. Powell and Dr. White of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse, or AAA, what's the third A? Alcohol Abuse?
And Alcoholism.
And Alcoholism. And the second question is, in Ohio, we saw sales of, and judged by tax revenue, from alcohol purchases since January and February, comparing those with the prior year and comparing March, April, May, since the lockdown has occurred, or the COVID-19 on March 18th in Ohio, we've seen tax receipts increase 36%. I assume that isn't just a buying it and storing it at home in case that you can't go out and buy it anymore, but I assume that's a consumption. Have the deaths related to alcohol, or what we call the deaths of despair, increased over this time period? So two different questions.
I'll start with the second one just because it's top of mind for so many people. I think, you know, we won't have death certificate data available to look at in that short a time frame. We're very interested in these questions. Depending on the data sources, and Dr. White, correct me if I'm wrong on this, some of the vast increases of sales come from off-premise sites, so liquor stores, et cetera, where you go and buy alcohol. But of course, your restaurants and bars were closed down, so you're not having sales from those. So we're very interested to look into the data more carefully. And we know that reports from people who deal with treatment centers and all say that, you know, relapse is a problem during these times of physical and then social isolation. But we really don't know the fine-grained behaviors yet. And so we're very interested in looking into that more carefully.
And what about can you trace the increase to the popularity of the U-curve all-cause mortality statistic? And what we mean by that, many of our listeners will know, but what we mean, it's a really sophisticated listening audience, but what we mean by that is that the death rate for the person who drinks no alcohol, or the person who drinks the woman who drinks more than one drink a night, or the man who drinks more than two drinks a night, increases compared to those who have one half to one for women and one to two for men. And has that caused an increase, or can you track anything, or has that caused a decrease in overall mortality rate?
Sure. Well, we are eager to find out. It'll be a while before we have any data on deaths. And there's a lot of this is going to have to be worked out, hopefully after the pandemic passes as quickly as possible. You know, collecting these data takes time. States have to report the data. So it'll be a little while before we know. But the thinking about alcohol mortality has changed over the last few years. There was a very compelling article in Lancet in 2018 in which the authors made the case that that you only see that U-shape or J-shape curve that you mentioned, where you get a reduction in mortality with alcohol consumption up until a certain level, and then you start to see an increase in mortality. You only get that if you use as your comparison group former drinkers and abstainers. Relative to former drinkers and abstainers, people who drink a couple drinks a day are less likely to die from a variety of causes. However, the case can be made that former drinkers and abstainers are not the appropriate referent group. They're different. For instance, many people who were former drinkers quit because of health reasons. They're called sick quitters. Many people who abstain because they can't afford alcohol, so they live in different circumstances. So when you compare drinkers to very, very light drinkers, like people who have a drink a week compared to people who have, you know, drink moderately, one or two drinks a day, those effects all go away with the exception of a reduced risk of mortality from heart attack. But death from all other causes increases pretty quickly after about a drink or two a day. And so a lot of the benefits that we thought came from moderate consumption of alcohol go away when you just change the methodology a little bit. So it doesn't look like there is much of a protective effect of alcohol on disease in general, again, except for perhaps heart attack. But if you live a healthy lifestyle and take care of yourself, there's no need to add alcohol to try to get that benefit.
So the point is that alcohol has a small, if any, benefit from that.
That is
true. And
yes.
The major problem we're seeing is an increase in, and I assume this is both alcohol-related traffic accidents, alcohol-related suicides, and alcohol-related liver and brain damage. Is that correct, or am I? Is it all of the above, or is it?
You're 66% correct. Fatalities due to alcohol-related traffic crashes continue to come down. The decline has slowed, but it continues to come down. But deaths from alcohol-associated liver disease, cancers, injuries, overdoses, all of those are going up.
We've been talking, and we have just too little time on these. So this is podcast number 1004, and we've been talking with two of the leaders of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, NIAAA, which is the United States' lead organization that both funds and does research on this and funds research in this area. As usual, we are brought to you by... I have one more question, by the way, that we'll ask in a few seconds. To find out, and you can both prepare for it or not, but that is, how do we compare with other countries and other countries seeing the same phenomenon? But we've been sponsored, as usual, by Persona Nutrition. If you go to My Persona, you can take the free assessment. It's a lot of fun. And then find out what you're missing or not, if you need anything or don't need anything. And you can talk to a nutritionist and find out all kinds of interesting things. Also, they are starting a program on to help people who are both overweight and have had surgery that is for weight loss and what they need, as well as a program for people who go towards intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating. That's at mypersona.com. Okay, Dr. Powell and Dr. White, how do we compare with other countries? Are other countries seeing the same phenomenon, or are we different, and why so?
I'm going to defer to Dr. White on this one, being the epidemiologist on the line.
Well, the World Health Organization tells us that alcohol-related deaths are going up in general around the world, and I can't tell you the trends in specific countries. If we look at the percentage of people who drink in the United States, fewer people in the United States drink than in Germany, in the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, France. And there has been this perception for a long time that somehow the way the French do it, for instance, is safer than the way that we do it. That, you know, the French, because they drink red wine, it's protective. Those beliefs have really given way to science. And the science tells us that what used to be called the French paradox was really a fallacy. The French aren't particularly healthy, particularly not because of the wine anyway. And if we look at our teenagers, you know, we tend to think, many people tend to think that in the United States, we have a problem with underage drinking because our drinking age is so high. But in reality, teenagers in France drink more. Teenagers in every European country drink more than our teenagers and are more likely to report getting drunk than our teenagers, with the exception of Turkey. So, you know, we're up there. We have, you know, quite a bit of harm related to alcohol. We're not alone. This is something that, really is present around the planet.
I want to thank you, too. You guys have been just outstanding, great information, and that's what is provided by our National Institute of Health. So thanks very much, and thank you for doing this. And thank you for bringing this to our attention. I guess the action step is, if you see someone who's having a problem, don't ignore it. Try and help them. And trying to help them means that you need a group to help them. Don't try and do it one-on-one, other than if they ask for your help directly. Is that...
Could I make a plug?
Yeah, and I want you to make a plug. That's why I stopped there.
Thank you. So NIAAA has a few resources that I think are fantastic for exploring your own alcohol use and also for figuring out how to get help for yourself and others. We have a website, if you just Google it, called Rethinking Drinking, which allows you to explore whether you meet criteria for an alcohol use disorder according to the latest criteria. Rethinking Drinking also helps you learn about the amount of alcohol in various drinks, the calories, etc. We have another site called the Treatment Navigator, and you can Google NIAAA Treatment Navigator. And this is a resource that helps people explore treatment options, the types of treatment available, and to find treatment in your local area. So I think those two resources together, Rethinking Drinking and the NIAAA Treatment Navigator, are really helpful for helping people determine if they need help and then finding help if they determine they do.
And it's always a good opportunity to reassess your relationship with alcohol. It's never a bad idea to just take time to do that.
And I want to thank you, Dr. Powell, and you, Dr. White, for such wonderful segments. And also Scott for great engineering, Pitch Hinning for Joe, who is having some internet trouble today and couldn't help us with the engineering. This has been 1004B. Remember, the A's are always the latest medical news of the week, as much of it non-COVID as possible, and what it means to you, how to live at the top of your curve for very long, for as long as you can. The B's are guests, great guests like this. Again, we're brought to you by My Persona, and I really want to thank you, those 50,000 or so people who download us every week. You're the reason we do this. Thanks very much. Tell your friends about us. Rate us weekly. Thanks again. We'll be back next week.